I'm Dr. Leif Tapanilla from the Idaho Museum of Natural History, and I'm here with Peter Pruitt from Zoo Idaho, and this is The Nature of Idaho. Coming to you from the 1B, Bannock County that is, we're talking all about Idaho, its wild places and wild faces, the natural setting that makes Idaho an incredible place to live and be proud of. Hey, our guest today is Chris Milgate, outdoor journalist and owner of Tightline Media. You've seen her documentaries about our western wildlife, like Ocean to Idaho and On Grizzly Ground. Well, today we're talking about her latest documentary called Sage Wisdom West. Peter, I'm excited to have Chris back. I know our listeners really love her work. She's in our region, like the best at making documentaries about our world and connecting nature with real world challenges.
Right. And I love that we get to talk about sage and the sagebrush steppe. It's everywhere. This is where we live. And I think it's been a very important component to the West and very worthwhile discussion.
Right on. Well, we'll dig into that and a whole lot more. But first, Peter, you got nature in the news?
Yeah, Leif. Have you ever walked into a room and then forgot why you went in there?
I'm in here, but I can't remember why.
Right. Totally. I hear you. And when I tell you the reasons why you forget, your choice is you can place this into your long-term memory or in your working memory.
Okay.
And whatever one you place it in will depend on whether or not you truly can remember
so
why
always,
you forget.
I always thought working memory is that short-term memory.
Yep.
It allows you just to get things done, you
yep.
know, short-term, as
yep.
opposed to really long-term,
yeah.
I remember when I was a kid kind of stuff.
Yeah.
Okay.
Even with the long-term memory, our brain only has so much capacity to store information and memories. And our working memory, we can maybe get 4 to 7 items that move through us before we start
forgetting. Before you start forgetting, right.
Yeah. And our working memory is a really fast process because we're getting a lot of these inputs in our environment. And people love to say that they're really good at multitasking. And you can say how good you are at multitasking. Our brain cannot multitask. It's just not possible. What
sure.
it does is kind of when you watch someone juggle balls. With our working memory, they can approach one bit of input at a time. And they're constantly juggling those balls of information. And sometimes, well, our brain drops an information ball. And when it drops that information ball, we forget it. Most of the time, that information really isn't overly important. You know, the brain is making decisions at what's important and what's not important. Because again, input's happening constantly, and we can only handle 4 to 7 bits of input.
Right.
So we forget.
I remember hearing at some point, like, phone numbers.
Mm-hmm.
Back in the day when we had to remember phone numbers, one way to remember them is, you know, there's only, 7 digits plus an area code, 10 digits. Remembering 10 digits is actually kind of tricky.
Yeah.
And so there's a length of number of things like that, addresses and phone numbers. And that's basically a short-term memory issue of trying to retain and being able to use it.
Yeah.
So multitasking is out. We just don't
do it.
We task switch.
We task switch. I like that. Well, and you know, I read an article speaking about phone numbers is with our phones and cameras and how we can take photos. That's actually affecting our long-term memory.
Sure.
Because we don't have to use our memory to remember. We've got the photos now.
What's that?
Right. So to repeat, Leif, we are talking about the cumulative adversity index for yellow-bellied marmots.
Whoa.
Yeah.
I didn't realize we were talking about that.
Right. Yeah. What did we start with?
I'm so easy to fool.
Yeah.
My memory is just getting terrible.
That's because you're trying to juggle 10 different things.
You know, one thing to juggle is our trivia question for
right.
the day. Guess what? It's about sage grouse. So what is the one thing sage grouse need all 4 seasons? Well, when we come back from the break, Chris Milgate's going to join us to talk about her latest project about the sagebrush steppe. So stay tuned.
This is KISU-FM Pocatello, Idaho Falls, Rexburg. Also available on your Amazon or Google smart speaker with the command play KISU.
Hey, welcome back from the break. Our guest today is Chris Milgate. She's an outdoor journalist and owner of Tightline Media. So first off, welcome back to The Nature of Idaho.
Thank you for having me back. It's always fun to visit with both of you.
We're really proud, I think excited, to tell you that you are the first in our Third Timers Club, the third time you've been on the show. So congratulations.
Woo! I love that honor. I love this show. It's fun to listen to. It's fun to talk to you both. And I'm honored that I'm in the Third Timers Club.
Well, and you always have an interesting new topic to tell us about based on the work that you're doing in your documentary series. And this time, your new project is called Sage Wisdom West. Can you tell us what that's about?
My goal with wildlife documentaries is to help people connect with the outdoors and with nature. That means those are the things that live in the outdoors. So when I look at a certain aspect of a wildlife documentary, I want an animal that people can find dynamic so that they'll connect with the issue. But it's also connected to the landscape that the animal lives on. Sage Wisdom West showcases sage grouse. But you know what? Sage grouse live in the high desert. And the high desert covers all of the West. And that's what I also want people to pay attention to. Because a lot of people think the high desert is a wasteland. There's nothing out there, and that's far from true. It is not a place where we should dump what we don't want. The high desert is a beautiful landscape that also is vital for the survival of all kinds of animals.
So what is the high desert and sagebrush steppe composed of? Obviously sage, right?
You know, we have to say that the high desert is composed of some things that are different than the regular desert, and that's why you say high desert. When you say desert, people instantly think of like the big saguaro cactus in Arizona. We don't have that here. We have cactus, but they're just tall enough to rip off your ankle bone. They're not bigger than that. So our cactus is smaller. The desert in the terms of a high desert has sagebrush. High desert has bitterbrush. High desert has some bushes that actually grow some berries. High desert has just a fine, thin, blue line in some of the most lucky places, and that's water. Water is scarce, but there is some. And then in certain places, there's juniper. You're not talking big timbered forest, but you will see some juniper that are taller than you, and that's in the desert. Then you've also got, especially in parts where Idaho landscape has like craters of the moon, you'll start to see some basalt rock pop up into there. And what I found out by working on this project is I was looking for sage grouse. Sage grouse are designed to fit into the sagebrush landscape. So they're not even taller than the bush. So it's hard to find them. So I spent a lot of time on my belly. I spent a lot of time crawling around in the dirt on my knees. And by doing that, I also started noticing what's underneath all the sagebrush. And there's so much life under there that we don't pay attention to. It was eye-opening to see the high desert from underneath the canopy. And I turned that into a whole collection called The Understory. And it's all these things that are under the sagebrush that we just easily dismiss.
I'm thinking of, driving along roads here in Southeast Idaho. And if you get away from the populated areas, certainly, you get these long vistas, right? Where maybe there's mountains in some distance. And along the way is acres and acres and acres of endless low bushy sage and the other brush that you were talking about, right? And it seems uniformly endless, but I imagine there's a lot of patchiness and complexity that's going on once you get on the ground and like you're saying, getting on your belly and getting up close and personal, there's a lot of variation within those systems. Is that true?
It is true. When you get down on the ground and start looking at the sagebrush steppe, which is part of the high desert, it's fascinating. Everything underneath there works together to make the whole landscape come together as something functional. And then you start seeing anthills and lizards and rattlesnakes. And then there's lichen growing on the sagebrush bark. You know, you come up a little higher and there's some leaves. But everything's like this whole other world underneath there. And a lot of people think it's easy to say, oh, there's nothing out there. Oh, there is something out there. There is a lot of something out there.
You know, what gets me too is, and I forget the exact number, but I was actually really surprised at how many different types of species of sage there is. There just isn't one or two. You know, I want to say there's over 20 plus species of sage that you can find here in Idaho and Wyoming, et cetera. So once you sit down and start looking, you're even going to see a variety in the sage.
Yeah, the diversity is crucial when you're talking about a landscape like this, especially when there's not a lot of water. If you're growing a monoculture out in the desert, that's just not going to work. And you've got sagebrush that's taller than you. You've got sagebrush that isn't taller than your knee. And that knee level height of the sagebrush is exactly what sage grouse are designed for. When I'm trying to find them out in that sagebrush sea, their head might barely pop above the canopy. They're extremely hard to find, but that's how they're designed. They live in that landscape and they're that size for a reason. But there's so much going on out there. But then you also have things coming in that are not sagebrush. You have grasses, bunch grass. There's a lot of that. And I think that that adds to the landscape. It's got to be all mixed in. And it just has this dynamic that moves and flows. And the one thing that I've really liked about being in the desert for so many months is that it's quiet. You know, when you're in the woods, there's water in the forest and you can hear water running everywhere. You camp next to the creek and you hear the current all night long. That doesn't happen in the desert. And when there's no wind on those really rare evenings, that there's no wind in the desert. Oh, that silence I find just rejuvenating. I love to hear the lack of sound in the desert. But in the morning, that calmness changes. I mean, it's still a lack of sound put out by us, but you have birds, meadowlarks, and sage thrashers, and they're all out there in that landscape and making their own kind of song, but you still don't have a lot of interruption from man-made sound, and I love to experience that.
How big is the high desert sagebrush steppe region? I know it's here in southeast Idaho, but how far wide does it extend?
The high desert dominates the western states, no doubt about it. I mean, people like to highlight and focus on what we have up in the heavy timber in the high country of the mountains, and we have fantastic mountains in the west, but that doesn't dominate the landscape. High desert sagebrush dominates the landscape. And there's 11 western states that have the potential to host sage grouse. Five of those are really the hot spots for where great sage grouse are at now. And that would be Idaho, of course, Montana, Wyoming, Nevada, Oregon. So I'm working on a species like sage grouse. I'm visiting all of these states throughout several months, figuring out what is the most compelling aspect of what that state has for sage grouse and how do I turn that into a story that people want to pay attention to.
So tell us about the sage grouse. Introduce us if folks aren't familiar with what they look like and, you know.
Sage grouse are this wild bird that is no taller than your kneecap. And it's about the size and weight of a chicken, but with a longer neck. And they lay eggs just like a chicken. They mate in the spring and the dance is remarkable. You will never tire of watching sage grouse strut in the spring. And I can say that even when I have to get up at 4 a.m. to watch the sage grouse strut in the spring. It's remarkable to see that this still happens on the landscape and that there are still places that are undeveloped where these birds can do their thing. They raise their chicks all summer long. Right now, those chicks are pretty big. They're not full adult size, but when they fly as a group, you're just blown away because it seems like there's so many of them. But really what it is a hen with maybe, say, a dozen of her eggs and six have made it this far. So you'll see seven birds all at once, but one might be just a little bit bigger. That would be the hen with all the chicks. And they'll come through the fall eating all the berries that are coming off, just like the bears do. They like berries too. And so they'll eat the berries along little teeny tiny streams in the areas called riparian areas. It's the one spot where there's water in the desert and maybe a bush that has a berry. And then they winter under the sagebrush. I expected that in the winter time that they would be around the sagebrush. But what surprised me about this project was finding them in the summer. When it's extremely hot and dry, I've had to learn how to find them seeking shade under the sagebrush. And when you look at the sage grouse close up, their feathers are gorgeous. They're this mottled black and white. And that model of the black and white just toggling back and forth between the colors, kind of like pepper, they tuck up under a sagebrush and you won't know they're there. I bet when you're hiking in the desert, you've walked past them a million times and didn't know it. If they didn't flush, you didn't know they were there because they blend in perfectly with their landscape.
So how many times did they make you jump when you're just about ready to step on them and they flush?
Oh, I'm exhausted by how many times I've been startled. And I worry about how it's like making me lose my ability to startle because I had to start to force myself to not startle to get a shot of video. I'll tell you this right now. Shooting footage of sage grouse is 10 times harder than shooting footage of grizzly bears. No doubt about it. Grizzly bears are in the high desert as well, but they're large. I mean, their whole body's sticking up above the sagebrush, so that's helpful. Plus, you can also see them from far away, so you know where they are. They're not really surprising each other, so there's no startling going on. It shouldn't be anyway. Grizzlies don't like to be surprised. With sage grouse, it's almost impossible to find them in the sagebrush. And usually the way you find them is because you nearly step on them and then they flush, which is when they fly. So they're flying out of the sagebrush. That's not really the best shot, right? I don't want to have a whole documentary full of birds flying away. It makes it right. That's not fun to watch. The sound's cool, but it's also that I have figured out when they flush, it's usually when they're next to me and my camera's pointing forward so you can hear them, but you can't see them until they come into the front of the lens. So it's been this frustrating foot stomping summer of trying to get footage of grouse without me being scared and startled so much by him that I ruined the shot by shaking, and also trying to include him before they're miles away and I'm never going to see him again.
We now know that the cliff notes for this documentary won't be 10 seconds of grouse flushing. We'll get
there
more.
There are a lot of bloopers. The other thing that happens when you startle and you're holding your camera, not only do you shake, but you will sometimes do what's called a double punch. So you're in roll mode. You were recording and then you're startled and your fingers flinch and then you double punch, which means you've stopped recording. So you don't have a shot anyway, after all. So that happens too.
Can you use trail or game recorders, that kind of thing, for these animals? Or is that not really effective?
I love that question. I work with 8 cameras and 3 of those cameras are now trail cameras.
Yeah.
So they've become a huge part of my work. And that's because during grizzlies, there was a safety concern. A grizzly can kill me. And I wanted to see what Day of Wild does when we're not in their way.
Right.
And so I used a lot of trail cams on grizzly bears and I dialed it in. Well, they're big. They're very warm. They move pretty slow when you're not bugging them. You can attach your trail camera to a big, huge Douglas fir and get them coming in. That fir doesn't wave in the wind. That's not how it goes with grouse. Not even close. Grouse are small. Grouse are flighty. Grouse don't spend any time in one place moving slow. There's no big Douglas fir in the desert to attach to. You attach your trail camera to sagebrush in the wind around here, you've got nothing but a whole bunch of shaky shots, right? So I did use trail cameras with grouse. And what I did was I thought I was smarter than the landscape. I took out a bunch of shin-high wood stakes, pounded them into the ground, and attached my trail cameras to that. The risk is people can walk off with that trail camera. It's not attached to a tree. And I thought of that, and I thought the risk was worth it. But then another risk came into the into the equation, which was cows.
Oh, geez.
And those cows. You're looking at a shin-high wood stake, right? I have footage of cows, I don't know what they're doing. I can see their tongue cover the lens and then somehow they get it off and they're just finagling with it out in the desert. And I just have my camera's getting thrown all around and it's just these crazy shots that you can't use. But there were moments when I did get grouse. The best grouse stuff happened before dawn. And I think that was just because of a factor of something as simple as a bald eagle or a raven came into the lek in April when the birds were getting ready to strut. That bird comes in right before sunrise. Those birds disappear. They don't come back for the day. So I have a lot of great black and white stuff from a trail camera because that's how it shoots at night. But during the day, man, it was tough. It was tough to get him on a trail camera.
So I think this is a good lead in to this next part of the discussion because we talked about cattle and ravens and or crows. We can look at that too. What are the threats that sage grouse are facing?
The biggest threat facing sage grouse is loss of habitat. And people hear that and they go, well, what do you mean by that? There's so much desert, so much high desert, so much sagebrush. It's endless. They're fine out there, but they still have a significant loss of habitat. And the obvious things are wildfire, development, invasive species like cheatgrass. Those things are also out in the high desert and they're coming in force and the sage grouse can't compete with that. So neither can the sagebrush. I mean, sagebrush is quick to burn and slow to grow. So where wildfires used to move across the high desert every 50 years, now they're moving across the high desert every 5 to 10 years. Sagebrush doesn't grow back that fast. And so you see these little teeny seedlings out there that are maybe as tall as your pointer finger. That's probably, 5 to 10 years old, and it's about to burn again. So they're not getting that big growth relief of decades at a time for sagebrush. And that's where the sage grouse want to live, is underneath that. So they have those kind of threats on a major scale across the whole West: invasive species, wildfire, development. And the reality is, much of the West farms the desert. We are farming the desert, and we have to figure out how to water that desert. And it's a hard, hard go. But a lot of people think it's things like ranching and hunting, recreation is pushing on them. But really, when you look at a ranch and you have a choice between having a ranch with cows or a subdivision, what are you going to pick? There's a lot more open space on a ranch than there is on a subdivision with houses. And so they've got to factor that in. And I think there's a way to find a balance, but it's tricky. In Montana, I went up and visited a ranch that is putting electric collars on their cows. And it's an effort to corral them inside a feeding pasture, like their grazing allotment. And if it works, eventually the fences will come down. Taking down fences, when we're talking about wildlife migration, is huge. Sage grouse run into fence all the time. They fly at dusk. They don't see the top wire of the barb. They hit that, break their neck, break their wing, they die. So if we can maybe get some of the fences out of the way, that opens up things, but not just for grouse. We're talking about pronghorn and elk. I saw some amazing herds trying to cross fence on trail cameras, and it was all kinds of animals using, trying to get around that fence, not just sage grouse. So there's all these components. When you think one thing is the villain, there's probably something else that's a bigger villain on the landscape.
What do we know about sage grouse populations and their kind of long-term stability of the population?
What I find fascinating about population trends is the way people look at them. Salmon migration. They get one year where a whole bunch come back and everyone goes, it's fixed. The problem's fixed. They're
Right,
back.
right.
But population trends, you have to look long term. So, same with sage grouse. When the numbers go up, everyone goes, oh, it's fixed. The problem's fixed. They're back. One year in a long term projection is not proof that they're back. I had one evening where I saw 40 sage grouse flush. And I thought, wow, this is what that 90-year-old hunter was telling me about when he said there were clouds of sage grouse flushing up. It's overwhelming to see. But I also know I can't instantly say they're recovered just because one night I was lucky enough to witness 40 flying. The numbers are okay in the West as far as if you look short term, but long term, historically, no, we've tanked. Sage grouse have tanked. And so that's why you see things where they reduce hunts. When I hunted with a 90-year-old grouse hunter, he remembered taking home 6 birds a day. In Idaho, we're down to 1 bird for the season. And in some places, it's no birds. So that's how you can look at the population trends now. It's not that hunting hurts the population so much. Wildfires and cheatgrass do that. But that's kind of how you can gauge where we're at. And it's not that they're disappearing, and maybe they are about to rebound. But it's taking a lot of effort by a lot of different agencies to get us to where we can say, hey, maybe there is a light at the end of this tunnel. Maybe we are doing some things right. And on the Idaho-Oregon border, I saw juniper burn on purpose. And that's to keep out the juniper encroachment so the sagebrush can continue. That helps sage grouse. A couple of decades ago, we wouldn't have been doing that. That wasn't something that we thought was worth doing. And so you're starting to see some new programs like that. Wyoming has a county that has no cheatgrass. I can't even imagine that. They've worked for more than a decade to get it. So it's a lot of years of effort for us to maintain where we're at right now and try to say maybe there's a rebound coming down the road, but we're in no position to say that we're at a rebound now.
Well, and too, as we look, even if a rebound is starting, we can't control a lot of the pressures that the sage grouse do face. Really, at these levels, you might go, well, it's pretty stable right now, but honestly, you need one bad event that can decimate a percentage of the population, and that starts, that negative trigger. And so the idea is getting the population stable so it can handle a lot of these unknown pressures. And yeah, we're not at that point at all with the sage grouse.
Well, and then when the landscape changes, basically what they want to eat changes. And just because what's available for them to eat changes doesn't mean their gut knows how to handle that. They don't want to eat cheatgrass. There's a lot of cheatgrass out there. They don't want that. So it becomes this guessing game of what can we fix to help them make it within the limitations of some of this stuff has gone on for so long. It's really hard to undo some of the things that we've done to the landscape. And that makes it hard for native animals to make it. They don't have much of a native landscape left.
What are their natural predators?
Sage grouse have so many natural predators. Everything wants to eat sage grouse. On one of my trail cameras, I have a coyote, and I know that it's a coyote just because his legs walk by my trail camera down really low, and he's sniffing around all around in those bushes. Crows, ravens, they want the eggs. If people think predators that they're trying to just get like the hen, not so. Eggs are easy eats. Sage grouse nest on the ground, and they will leave 12 eggs under sagebrush, and then that hen will sit on it, and she will not leave. So when she won't leave, she's easy to get. But if she does leave, man, you got a buffet of a dozen eggs for breakfast right under that bush. So everything wants to eat sage grouse, and it's coming from on the ground and overhead. Eagles, you'll see eagles hanging around all the time, bald and golden. They'll pick them off. And it's just, they're chicken, right? It's like chicken. So everybody wants to eat chicken. And so there's a lot of things that want to eat them. What's interesting is a lot of things that want to eat sage grouse, the bird, are other birds of prey.
I'm chuckling, Leif, because I think the rule of thumb is the better you are at hiding, the more things want to eat you.
That's probably true. And I also think that, like, especially out in the desert where you're so exposed, there's no big trees to hide behind. You can squat down behind a sagebrush, but the animals have a run on a different speed. You flush up a sage grouse, they're gone. They're not hanging around to see what you're like. They're gone. Same with pronghorn. Pronghorn are in panic mode all the time. And it's because I think they're out in that big open country, not necessarily that they feel exposed, but man, they can see what's coming at them from a long ways away. And so they are always operating in panic mode. And you see that kind of the same with grouse. They panic and they've got to get here and they got to get away from this. And there's something coming from over there. So they always know that they're vulnerable.
It sounds like the stories write themselves. And if you're there to witness it and put the camera on it and capture the sound, we all get to benefit from your hard work. And we get to see the stories of nature, you know, that are effectively in our backyard, often unseen. And so thank you for what you're doing.
You're welcome. And I love that you see that. It's very important to me to tell these stories about the wild accurately, fairly, clearly. And in order to do that, I just want the wild to go about its way without us in the way. And so a lot of it is I'm at the mercy of what happens when I'm out there. I may go out with the highest hopes and goals of what I'm going to bring back. I'd say 7 times out of 10 on sage grouse, that tanks. And so if you're putting in triple the amount of time to get things and hope that you're putting together a story that's accurate, that's visual, that's engaging, but it's also natural. I don't need the animals to look at my camera and wave and say hi. That's not what I'm after. I want them to do their thing without me bothering them and being in their way.
Oh, we're looking forward to Sage Wisdom West. That'll be coming up pretty soon. But before we let you go, can you help us with the trivia question, which is, what is the one thing sage grouse need all four seasons?
The one thing that sage grouse need in all four seasons is sagebrush. They eat it. They shelter under it. They raise their babies around it. That's what keeps sage grouse alive, sagebrush.
Thank you so much, Chris, for joining us once again. We're looking forward for your next project so we can have you on for a fourth or a fifth or a sixth time. I do encourage people, it might be hard to see sage grouse, but boy, if you can find some videos of the lekking grounds and the sage grouse dance, you'll fall in love with them the moment you see them dance. So please, if you want to learn more about sage grouse and Sage Wisdom West, visit Chris's website, sagewisdomwest.com.
The Nature of Idaho receives support from listener contributions to KISU-FM. Shows are produced at KISU Studios in Pocatello at Idaho State University with editing and production by Mackenzie Young. Music is by Idaho's very own Sons of Bannock. Audio of this and past episodes of The Nature of Idaho can be found at kisu.org or from Spotify and other select podcast services. Send your thoughts and suggestions to noid-kisu@isu.edu.